There.
Hey,
Remember me?
who are you?
Okay.
And how long have you been here?
I've been here for 20 years. Name is Larry Osterman. 20 years, started in August 27th, 1984.
Wow, I
My
graduated from high school in '83, so it's
yeah.
taking me
Well,
back.
the story I love telling is that when my son was born, babysitter was a wonderful young lady named Kelly Bora. Kelly had a 12-year-old son, or 12-year-old son, 12-year-old brother. Kelly was 14, Todd was 12. Todd works here now. His office was around the corner from me. I knew him when he was my son's age. And that freaks me out. It freaks me out every time I see that because, I've been working here for just about all his life. There are people here who are at Microsoft today who were not born when I started working here. And that's a mind-boggling concept. It really is to me. But the reality is I do. I've been working here for so long, I'm having fun. And that's when I stop. I stop when it stops being fun. That's the way I look at it. And even if you just think about it in terms of landing a dream job, it's winning the lottery. I ran into a company where I have the opportunity to do anything I want to. I can do anything in this company, and that's incredible. I mean, there's no other company in the world where, literally, if you are a computer programmer, there's nothing you can't do. I mean, you can write computer games, you can write operating systems, device drivers, you can work on web servers, web services, apps, anything you want to do, you can do it in this company, and you don't have to change jobs. I mean, I've done two dozen different things. I've done networking, multimedia, all sorts of stuff, but never had to leave the company to do it. And when that's the cool thing. It's like, you do something, you work there for 5, 6 years, you get bored. Other people will leave a company, move on to another company. I just find a new group to work in, and it works out really quite
That's the
nicely.
advantage of a big
Of a big,
diverse
diverse company, it's the diversity that gets it, that makes it worthwhile.
My friend worked at Lockheed for 30 years and said the same thing. He said, we get tired of something and so move over to a
My
different
kid's
company.
sister actually used to work at Lockheed until they spun off her unit. She's does she writes proposals for privatizing food stamps. There's a whole company that does nothing but sell food stamp programs to states, the computerized systems to run food stamp programs, and they sell these packages of it's the cards, it's the readers, the cards and the readers, the training for all that. It's all the stuff that she does, and it's wild to me.
What kinds of things have you done here at Microsoft?
What have I done? Okay, let's see. I started out in multitasking MS-DOS 4.0, the product that no one ever heard of. On my blog, it's the most popular post I've made, with the exception of the 20th anniversary post. Because everybody, no, the multitasking operating system in 1984, no, Microsoft never did that. No way. Well, yeah, we did. A real mode multitasking operating system never saw the light of day outside of a couple of OEMs in Europe. But it existed, we did it, and I started out writing disk drivers for that. Let's see, what else have I done? I did the POP3 and
Why did
IMAPS.
they get killed? Why
Why
did
did it get killed? Fundamentally because we pitched it to IBM, and IBM said no. But you know what? This multitasking idea, we like this. We have some different ideas. How about we collaborate on something else? And that's where OS2 came from. So many of the core concepts, the disk drivers, in fact, that I worked on are part of OS2, or, well, were. This is OS2 1.0, so it's, 15 years ago. But the drivers are there, the core concepts are there, and a lot of the core architecture, now obviously, that long gone, but that's essentially, it was because there were no customers for the product. There were a couple of OEM contracts that we fulfilled, but that was fundamentally what happened. And that happens a lot. It happens more than you think, actually, and you realize that projects get started, they get run, you get to a certain point, and then you realize that there's no customers for it, or you can't develop the customers for it, and it doesn't go to the market. See, what other things have I done? I said the POP3 and IMAP4 servers for Exchange, and a lot of the NNTP server and some of the networking stuff for the LDAP server there. Let's see, what else did I do? I spent a couple of years working on a chip that's used for home automation. Yeah, and it's actually, there's one of them up there on the shelf back there.
Okay.
Sorry. This is the actual chip.
Okay.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to be silly. I'm just going to turn that around there. Sorry.
Is that when your original business cards are?
Actually, it's from when we moved to this campus back in 86. All
right.
But it has the old logo on it, which is what I think is kind of cool. This is actually the first Microsoft logo.
Yeah.
That right there. That's before we had the Pac-Man logo, even before the Blibbit. That's from like the late 1970s.
You got a little museum in your office.
I have a little museum in my office. I have a whole bunch of little stuff. I mean, it's little things like that. The blue book over there actually is the original MS-DOS encyclopedia. That was done as part of a grand reference library that Microsoft was going to be producing, that was going to produce the definitive state of the art of computing in 1986. It was one of the very first MS Press books.
Wow.
And unfortunately, due to a number of issues that came up after production, it was essentially canceled after the very first set of books were run. And we later on actually did a second version of it, which was reasonably popular and actually was really a quite a remarkable technical achievement, to be absolutely honest. I don't know if you can. It was quite a remarkable technical achievement, because we got all of the developers, or Press got all the developers involved in the development of DOS to review the articles. They got essentially the who's who of MS-DOS technical writers to write the articles for it. Van Wolverton was in there, Charles Duncan, all sorts of major names in tech writing at the time, and it actually was reasonably popular. And I wrote about it in the blog a while back, and I've actually got comments from people saying, yeah, I still have that thing on my desk, and it's great.
Wow.
But it's one of those things that, you know, you just never know. But yeah, I've got all sorts of stuff up there that's, you know, up on the top left-hand side is the original NT specification, the big OS 2 design workbook.
Yeah.
That's the original specification for Windows NT. It's massive, it's big, it's got all sorts of stuff in it. It's the most... When we did NT, NT was the best documented, best specified product that Microsoft had ever done. It was an original goal of NT that the design team had, is that we were going to specify, we were going to get everything written down. It was all going to be documented so that we would actually have real honest-to-goodness specs. And the really amazing thing is, those specs have held up. I actually used one of the specs in there a month ago. I pulled out the design work a month ago for some stuff I was doing involving audio. I was doing some prototype work for something. And I ended up actually using one of the specs in there. And it's still just as valid today as it was back, you know, 1989.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I remember seeing NT when I was in college for the first time.
Yeah? Well, NT actually is...
What did you do on the NT team?
NT, I wrote the network file system for NT. I wrote the...
How many lines of code is that?
I don't know. Well, it's no longer part of NT, actually. It's gone.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't remember lines of code. It's a couple thousand. 10,000, something like that. I don't know. Maybe it's more. I just don't remember. But yeah, I wrote the network file system, and I wrote the browser, which is actually what lives underneath the network neighborhood. When you say, look at view the entire network, that whole set of functionality.
Yep.
From is.
So when that thing's slow, we can blame you.
You can blame me, actually. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, you can blame me. Feel free. It's all my fault, even though I have not looked at a line of that code for close to 10 years. But it's still there, and it's still, you know, because it's all there. It's all the same stuff. So NT was different back then. It's so much. It is a very different. The whole company is very different. But it's really wild how much stuff has changed.
Yeah.
So.
In 1990, the company was, what, 10,000 people or 7,000?
Maybe like that, something like that. I don't even remember. I don't keep track of that at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't that many people. The systems were small. we had systems in place to deal with a development team of about 300 people. That's about what NTU was. Right. And we knew how to do engineering for 300 developers and another 300 so testers. And that size of project, we knew how to do. We had that nailed. And then it started growing. And Windows 2000 came out, and XP in 2003. And it's been it was fascinating because the stuff that we did back in NT4 and NT3.5 and well, et cetera, they didn't scale. They didn't scale the modern to the develop the size of the projects that we have today. And I know you've had some talks, you've videos with Ian McDonald about a lot of what ended up happening and how we changed. And we had to. We had to reinvent what we did. And actually, we're now in the process of reinventing ourselves, reinventing the the development paradigm. Again, that's the whole, the Longhorn restart, they call it, and there have been articles about it. And it's all about re-architecting how you do software engineering, because software engineering, the way we were doing business did not scale. Yeah. And now we have to come up with a new way of doing business that will hopefully scale for the next 4 or 5 or 6 releases of operating systems. It's interesting. As I said, the things we could get away with. Oh, we have a new feature. Okay, well, we'll just sit down and we'll write a 5-page spec on it and pass it around to a couple people and we'll just add it to the product.
Yeah.
And that's, at some level, that's how stuff ended up getting in. It was that simple.
It's
not that simple anymore. It is, oh man, it is not even close. Yeah.
Does that turn off developers thing? That there's too much process in the system,
yeah,
and it's hard to ship anything, it's hard to make an impact.
It turns off a class of developers. You know, a lot of the people who were here back in the early days, there's no way they would tolerate the level of bureaucracy and the level of just stuff that goes on that you have to deal with. Oh no, I found a bug. Okay, now we have to take the bug to war team and get it approved and this and that and the other thing. People would not have tolerated that. Oh, I found a bug. Okay, I'm just going to fix it. The problem with, oh, I'm just going to fix it is that it really doesn't scale. You know, my favorite example of I'm just going to fix it is Windows 1.0. The developer in charge of printing decided that there was a horrible design flaw in the printing subsystem. So he needed to redesign how printer drivers worked in Windows. He did this about 2 weeks before they shipped. Your face is cringing. Everyone's face should be cringing right now. He went ahead and rewrote the code. And then he handed it over to the testers, one of whom happened to be my fiance, my wife, current wife. And he handed it to the testers and said, here, just run a test to make sure it works. And when he came in the next morning, there was a pile of paper about a foot and a half high on his desk. And he calls up the testers and says, "No, give me just the failures. I don't want to see all of the output. Give me, just tell me what went wrong." And they responded saying, "No, you don't understand. Those are the failures. We kept the successful test cases out. This is all the stuff that you just broke." Oh. And fortunately, the good news is it didn't go in, because on the basis of that, it didn't happen. But back then, it wasn't considered to be a big deal. They didn't care that it was a horrible idea, that you don't destabilize the system weeks from shipping. It wasn't important. They just wanted to write their code and get it done and move on. So yeah, the structures, the strictures chafe people. They really do.
Yeah.
But you have to live with it. That's the way life works. And you know, you learn to live and adjust and adapt to the to the structures and whatnot.
What are all these puzzles?
Puzzles? Oh, these are my toys. These are my toys. I love manipulative puzzles. I always have loved manipulative puzzles. And my wife has been getting me, has been buying them for me for years and years and years. And I keep them here on my desk because it's something for people to do when they come in, and it is a huge conversation piece. People come in, they say, they sit down in the chair, and we chat for a while, and they sit there and play with the manipulative puzzles.
Yep.
And it's I find it a wonderful conversation starter, and it's fun. And I love them. And some of these are just, some of them are just cool. In particular, there's a guy by the name of, I believe it's Michel Giron. He's a French gentleman who makes these incredibly intricately machined manipulative puzzles. And you open these up, you take something out of them. Okay. But the machining is just incredible. These are all, this thing weighs probably half a pound. It's a huge, it's a really nice precision pieces of engineering. They're really cool. And, you know, some of these things are just, they're really detailed and they're just cool. They're fun to play with. They're fun to touch.
Right.
And just fiddle. I find that I am an inveterate fiddler. I have to have something in my hand that I just play with, and that's what I. So these become sort of therapy, if you will.
How did you get into them? Like, what was the?
My wife got me something. I don't even remember what it was. Just, you know, found it in a catalog. Thought I'd love it, and I did, and I fell absolutely in love with it. No, actually, I'm sorry. That's close to right. You go to the Pike Place Market, and they have these booths, Uncle's Puzzles, with these great big wrought iron manipulative puzzles. And every time we go in there, I would be fiddling with them, and I just playing with the ones on display, and I take them apart and put them back together and again. And Valerie eventually said, you know, you're having so much fun with these things, and you're good at making them, putting them together and taking them apart. And so she started getting me them for Christmas, and it's just turned into this huge tradition that every year I get a couple, two, three, four, five, some number of these manipulative puzzles. And so I take them, I get them at home, I play with them for a while, I solve them, and then I bring them into the office and let my coworkers have at them.
Yep.
And so